The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 160.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to speaking with. He's one of my favorites. I've been listening to his stuff for a long, long time. He's really helped shape my thinking, and he's a fellow hockey player. We'll get into that in just a moment. He really needs no introduction, named Keith McCullough. Keith, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey, thanks, George. It's great to be with you.
And I knew I just threw that one on you. I wanted it to be a surprise. I didn't mention it when we were talking earlier. But I actually played ice hockey when I was a kid for 7 years, all the way up to my last year in Pee Wee's.
Oh, nice. I did not know that. That's a great surprise. What made you stop, man?
I started playing golf, and I had to kind of choose between one or the other. So I ended up sticking with golf and leaving hockey behind. That, and I grew up in Portland, Oregon. So I was playing for the Pee Wee All-Star team. We'd go up to Seattle, and we'd do okay when we'd go to Spokane or Seattle or anywhere within the States. But then we'd go up to Vancouver or up to Burnaby and or Victoria, and we would just get smoked.
Yeah,
it was like the score of a football game, like 20-0. And the kids were huge. I was like 12 years old. These guys are 6'3" going around and just, like, it was just a complete train wreck. So I knew I had no future in hockey once we crossed the border up north.
Well, that place, the Burnaby Winter Club, they have one of the best amateur hockey programs in Canada. They roll a lot of different teams from a lot of different countries, so I wouldn't feel too much shame about that, George.
All right, well, let's go from hockey, a full contact sport, into something that now is probably just as much of a full contact sport, if not more, and that's macro.
Yep.
And what is your view on what's going on? I mean, everything's completely up in the air. I listened to an interview that I loved the other day with Grant Williams and Chris Cole, two of my favorite guys, and Bill Fleckenstein, where Chris was really talking about now fundamentals just don't even matter. It's all about flows. I wanted to start by getting your opinion on that before we get into some of the quad stuff.
Yeah, and Cole in particular is an interesting opinion and certainly one that I hold in high regard because he starts from the same place that I start, which is not the price of the market, but the volatility of the market. And I think that's more or less, you know, what he was probably saying when he said nothing matters. I mean, you can give me a headline on pretty much anything. By the way, if you did give me the headline, illegally gave me the headline, and I'd be wearing an orange jumpsuit on the Pfizer news, you know, I mean, what would you have done with that? I mean, a lot of people would have said, well, I'm just going to buy a lot of stocks, and you would have got killed in all the stocks that everybody owns because the NASDAQ was down in the, you know, in the 3% range immediately following that. And the S&P, kind of like the broad market, was only up 1%. So, you know, really, you know, it's a narrative-driven market, and there's a ton of volatility. There's actually more what we call cross-asset class volatility than we've ever seen before. And really, it is a factual statement that the flow, or what I call the machine, really is driving that incremental price momentum, and it's forcing people to chase high and to sell low. And that's a pretty good environment, I mean, for somebody like me, because I like to risk manager, or God forbid you call it trading it, but that's what you do with an environment like that. I quite like it.
Yeah, so let's go into that. I was listening to some of your interviews earlier today where you're talking about the machine and talking about Quad 4 specifically. And can you walk us through your entire framework just from someone who knows nothing about Hedgeye or what you do?
Yeah, what we're trying to do on that first part is front run the machine. The machine just means the 80-90% of daily trading that is systematic. You do have the interesting thing now, all the hoodies or all the retail accounts, you know, taking up some of that share, but they're also quite forceful when it comes to, you know, chasing. The main thing that the machine cares about is immediate term price momentum or 1 month price momentum, whether it's going up or going down. So if the machine sees it's going up, it's going to make it go up more. If the machine sees it's going down, it's going to make it go down more. So what I did was I built a process to, like I said, front run that. What I want to be is on the front end of what causes the machine to do A or B, to go up or down. And you know, the quads, you know, it looks or might sound to some people, it sounds elegant. To people that are more mathematically inclined, we'll hear that word. To people that don't do math, they'll just say, "What the hell's that?" The quads are basically four economic outcomes. Okay, so we have The secret to the universe is the modeling process, which is calculus. So you only need a 10th or 12th grade education to kind of understand what it means. So what we're trying to do is measure and map the rates of change, again, using the calculus of it all, of growth and inflation at the same time. So when you have you have two different factors, growth and inflation. Again, if people don't want to take my word for it, Ray Dalio built Bridgewater on the same point. These are the two most causal factors in front running the machine. Okay, so if you have two factors, you have four outcomes. You have quad one, where you have inflation falling and real growth accelerating. That's the best for human beings. That's the quad where even value stocks work, because typically you're coming out of the bottom of an economic cycle. You have quad two, where the economy, and again, it just follows the path of a cycle. You get an economy that's good, you know, quad one, then economy that overheats, where inflation and growth are accelerating at the same time. So quad two, and we back-tested literally any asset class in each quadrant, so that's why people really care about what quad you're in environmentally. So again, if you have sunshine and quad two, then you're going to basically buy anything, and you're going to short the things that people have been making money on for a long time, which includes treasuries and gold and things of that nature, because they don't like quad two. Once you get to quad three, you have what we call economic stagflation. So you have inflation going up and you have real growth going down. That's where the people get screwed. And the rich people, or whoever, the people that are front running the machine, are getting paid. It's just that the people are paying the bill. So their cost of living is going up, their costs, their rent, their healthcare costs, commodities, food, oil, gas, et cetera. And then you got quad four, which is the danger zone. And that's the one that people typically look to us for a heads up. That's when you have neither growth nor inflation going up. You have them both going down at the same time. So what we call that is deflation. And in deflation, as you know, there are very few things that you can own. One thing that really works well in quad four is the dollar. It's the only quadrant that it goes up. Treasuries love quad four, but a lot of things get what we just call getting quad four. They get annihilated. They get crushed. And even the Bitcoin maximalists hate it when I say that.
Yeah. So are we in quad four right now?
No. No, episodically, we've had a couple big quad fours. Quad four, the biggest one that we had prior to COVID hitting, which was a big quad four in Q2 of 2020, was going back to Q4 of 2018. So that's when a lot of people got caught off sides. And what typically happens with a quad four, it's just like, I think of markets and I think of economies much like anything else in natural life. So they have emergent properties, not unlike an earthquake or a hurricane or an avalanche. They develop these properties, these causal factors that become riskier, and then you have an episodic collapse, and then things come back again. So that's why quad four is typically what I would say is episodic and non-trending, like it doesn't happen for years at a time. But when it happens, you can lose 20, 40, 50, 100% of your money. So you got to be very careful about those. Currently, we don't have a quad four in the U.S., but we have one in Germany. And, that's the other thing about our process. It's a go-anywhere process, so to speak.
That's
so
interesting.
So we measure and map using the four quad model 50 different countries in the world. So, Turkey is in quad four. Brazil just came out of quad four. The USA was episodically in quad four throughout September, but it wasn't trending. So that's where we're at on that.
Okay, so what was the US right now?
We're going into what we call quad two, which is quad two is where you get interest rates go up and you start to get a lot. And this is primarily why bank stocks and energy stocks have finally stopped going down and start going up. Quad two, again, is when you get real inflation. And what's interesting about this is that the Fed is now just basically taking the lid off whatever their bullshit target for inflation is, and they're going to let it run hot. And that's actually going to run really hot. But within 3 to 6 months from now, we think inflation is going to be at the highest level than even on the government statistics, which, as you know, are also bullshit. They're going to be it's going to be running hot. And quad two is where we're trying to tilt our asset allocations.
So how do you see that through yield curve control? Because I think I heard you this morning on another interview, you're talking about interest rates going up. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you said the Fed is going to have a hard time managing that. And I just remember reading that Brainard is kind of in line or at the top for the Treasury position.
Yeah.
And I know she's been all about yield curve control. So how do you see that? And do you believe that they're not going to be able to cap those interest rates, or how do you see it?
Well, it's hard to understand what the next central planner, whether it's Lyle Brainard or if it's still going to be Powell or it's going to be some other flavor of the month with MMT on top of it and makes everyone feel good until they actually do it and tell you. Right. But the way that I look at yield curve control, you know, there's two different kinds, at least two flavors that look to be popular. And again, I'm not a big fan of central market planners. I don't think that, you know, God put them on the earth to bend and smooth economic gravity, albeit they've tried. They try really hard, but they don't quite seem to get the economic outcomes that they promised people. But that said, you know, yield curve control, you can either do it Japanese style. You know, Japanese style is pretty simple yield curve control, which is you don't have a yield curve. In other words, all interest rates are at zero. They're not like deeply negative like they are in Germany. The 10-year yield in Germany is minus, you know, 0.65%. The 10-year yield in Japan is zero. So that's yield curve control. There's absolutely nothing going on. That's why you'd never buy a Japanese bank, because there's nobody makes money. There's no VIG. There's no yield curve to capitalize on. The yield curve that the U.S. has basically said, hey, look, we're interested in, at least from what I've heard amongst the academic types, is that, well, we like keeping we like anchoring or controlling the low end of the curve and letting the long end of the curve trade with free markets, or at least kind of trade with free markets. Now, so that, you know, when I hear it that way, that's why, George, I'll say, well, the Fed's going to have a problem with that, because if I'm right on inflation in particular, growth and inflation accelerating at the same time, what happens is that interest rates go up no matter what the Fed's trying to do. So that's what happened in 2013. That's what, of course, happened in 2018. And then the Fed is late to the party. They don't, like, rates, interest rates don't go up because the Fed raises interest rates. The Fed raises interest rates after interest rates are going up to validate that they have some semblance or clue of what's going on, which they absolutely don't.
What if we have inflation going up, negative real growth, and they try to increase interest rates? Won't that really be detrimental to the economy?
Well, that'll put you in quad four. Like, that's exactly what happens, George, which is they did it. That's exactly what happened in Q4 of 2018. Is that they started to raise interest rates and they perpetuated deflation. You know, so you cannot have your cake and eat it too. You can't have bubbles upon bubbles upon bubbles built on cheap money or the cost of capital being zero, and then all of a sudden, you know, start raising interest rates after they go up. And that's the whole, I think that's the key, at least to how I think about it, which is, and this is the history of the Federal Reserve. They raise rates after they've gone up. They don't make them go up. So then they raise them one more time and you get that final thrust and the market says, hey, I really don't like that. And you get deflation of asset prices, and then the Fed has to do what? They have to cut interest rates. So it's that's the game that they put themselves in.
How important do you think asset prices are in the mindset of the Fed? Or I'm not even going to throw in the politicians, because I don't think they can barely pronounce their first name. But as far as the Fed or the central banks in the developed world, you call it Japan, Europe, the United States, how important do you think they think asset prices are to the overall economy?
Critical. And they grossly understate that's the answer to the question. I mean, if you go to where, like, the forefather of all this, Ben Bernanke, has taught the Japanese to do it, there's absolutely no apologies at this point. The Japanese not only own, you know, every single Japanese government bond that wasn't locked down, but they bought significant, and they're the majority holder of the stock market. You know, like, we have not done that part in the U.S. yet, but we've done everything that we possibly can to try to suppress market volatility after it goes up and keep asset prices high. I mean, that's exactly what, that's, again, private equity Powell, or P.E. Powell, has his name for good reason. I mean, he is going to make damn sure that the asset prices underpinning private equity valuations never go down. And the stock market, once it goes down quickly, they can't let that happen either. Now, this, of course, continues to play out further and further in time. And what you find is, and this is kind of the point that I think that Cole would have made, which is you're actually getting more and more volatility with every increment of debt that you put into this puppy. It's been the outcome. Like, the Fed can't control these episodic rips in market volatility or collapses in the price of markets, which is the inverse of the volatility. And you're seeing the biggest moves in volatility ever. And I always say this to people, I mean, if you didn't know, ever is a very long time.
Yeah. You know, another thing, or another angle that Chris Cole has is he's talking about volatility and that you can't destroy it. You can really only move it. And his point is that the Fed does come in with, let's say, more QE to try to prop up the market, the Fed put, if they're able to achieve that. He thinks the volatility could move from the markets over into social unrest because the wealth gap is increasing so much. So it's not just volatility in markets. That volatility, if Chris is right, can bleed over into the real economy and then into potential riots or looting. Who knows? You know, one thing about Japan, I've talked to Snyder about this a couple times, Jeff Snyder, and, you know, he always points, because I've brought this up with him, and he says, well, the Fed can try to do whatever they want, and they can try to come in and set up these special purpose vehicles to buy equities. You know, Japan did that, to your earlier point, and they couldn't prop up the market. So do you think if we get another dramatic downturn, let's say 20-25%, I think it's obvious the Fed will come in and try to do something, but do you think they'll be successful, or what probability do you give that?
Well, I mean, the Fed's probability of being successful from a very low price after shit hits the fan is very high, right? I mean, the whole point that people miss is that the volatility ripping and the collapse of the price in the meantime. And they're putting more people, think of it like a plank that they're putting people out, and there are sharks in the water. And they're walking more and more people onto the plank. The shark is the volatility, and it's there. And as you keep jamming more and more people onto the plank, you know, in the beginning it was just institutional investors, and then it's hedge funds with leverage, and now it's hoodies. You know, so now you have everybody out on the plank. I think that that's probably, at least in terms of how you just depicted it, and I think I agree with that, that it can and will end in some short-term, I hope it's short-term, that's the history of social unrest, but you know, these things are going to happen if it all comes down on everybody as opposed to just on Wall Street this time. There's a lot of participation. There's the most participation in nominal terms ever by the retail community. It doesn't have to be the 1999 period, it's 2020. And I think that that's a big problem. And in addition to the fact, the other side of what you said, social unrest is also a function of, let's just say oil prices double from here. Okay, so if the dollar collapses, which you know, is basically our view, and that's what happens in Quad 2 anyway, and you have MMT to suppress it and devalue it, and you have both the Fed and the fiscal, you know, printing it and spending it, the dollar is going to go down, 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 and the cost of living, everything you buy in dollars, is going to go up, up, up. And that's the social unrest that you can already see. They just don't have the same voice. You know, once you start doing it to all the hoodies that are trading in their accounts and to the people who've never traded in their life because they're just quite literally trying to put a roof over their kid's head and feed their family, now you got a lot of pissed off people. And I think that I wouldn't consider that a low probability event if the dollar does indeed collapse from here.
What would you say to people that I get this pushback on my channel all the time? They'll say, okay, I get what you're saying about QE, George, but if you look back at, you know, 2008 to today, we've had QE1, QE2, QE3, we've had not QE, and it didn't really create this hyperinflation, or it didn't even create stagflation. So why on earth should the next round of QE or whatever they're going to call it, why is inflation now? Why, you know, you've been crying wolf for the past 10 years, or you Austrians have been doing so. Why is it different this time?
Well, I think a lot of people are affected, you know, just, you know, they're on tilt, or they're affected emotionally or personally or politically on just about anything that you might say, right? So let's just put that on the table. If your view is that inflation is some big bang thing that is perpetual, that's not really a good thing to say. Like, I mean, it's like inflation is like everything in life. It comes on slowly and then all at once. And it punishes the unprepared. It doesn't matter that you make a 10-year call or a 10-month call on inflation. It's on the rate of change of inflation. Like in fractal math, we always focus people on this very basic point. It's not about the average of things or the average of prices or the average of inflation. It's about the particular thing at the particular time. You know, that is sand pile theory. That's avalanche analysis. It's anything you want to look at. It's when that last snowflake or that last pile, you know, last grain of sand creates the event. And the event, if you're not prepared for it, you're too late. It's not like some kind of event that everybody can kind of boil themselves in water and become a frog. I mean, it's just not the way that it works. So I think your view on inflation is going to be right big time for a period of time that not enough people are going to be able to deal with it. And that's a problem. Think of like all the no income to low income people currently. I mean, you're just going to take up their cost of living by another 5, 10, 20%, depending on, again, simple math. If I take down the value of the dollar by 5, 10, 15%, you know, the price of everything is going to go up. Maybe not on a linear basis that way. They actually go up even faster. I mean, that's actually what you're seeing. You know, whether it be lumber prices, because housing demand was also strong, or, you know, the most recent rip in oil prices. And that was kind of one of the last of the Mohicans here. We've had the entire ag complex go off to the upside after hitting five-year lows when the dollar was strong. So again, if you get the dollar right, which I think it's going down, you're going to get the rate of change of inflation right, and you're going to be right for some period of time that really matters.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Why do you think the dollar's going down? I mean, we talked about MMT. We've talked about all this money printing, the stimulus from the government, the Fed coming in, monetizing the debt and all those things. But then there's the pushback of dollar-denominated debt outside of the United States. And if we continue to bring on more and more debt, and all the Federal Reserve can do is increase the amount of bank reserves, well, it doesn't necessarily bleed into the real economy. I know MMT is kind of a transfer mechanism, but what's kind of your rebuttal to that pushback when the people talk about all this dollar denominated demand outside the United States because of the debt?
I mean, the back test of the quads, that's the number one answer. I mean, I can then start to talk for 5 minutes or 5 hours on explaining the whole edifice of it. But if I go through all 50 countries on why that is so, just think about it in common sense terms. So when China, Japan, pick any emerging market country, goes into quad one or two, their currencies go up against the dollar. You know, their economies are growing again. So we went for a long period of time, basically from the beginning of 2018 until most recently, May of 2020, when the entire world was in quad three or quad four, particularly China and emerging markets. So their currencies are collapsing. And then you get the real dysfunctional countries like Turkey and Argentina, you know, collapsing at a faster rate. Dollar's going up at a faster rate. So the dollar is just the inverse of everything else. And that's something, you know, there will be a point at some point in maybe the middle or the back half of next year where China and emerging markets start to slow again. But that's not what's going on right now. China's economic data on a weekly, on a monthly, on a quarterly basis is accelerating. And that's the case for a lot of emerging market countries as well. So again, dollar's going to go down just because everything else is going up. That's one basic point. Then you can have the bigger bang theory, which is this MMT thing. Like, this is a real thing. These people believe this. Like, yeah. that you print the money and then you spend it fiscally. I mean, that, you know, there's plenty of history to remind people, you know, from a long time ago, Germany, to, I mentioned a couple countries most recently, Argentina and Turkey in particular, where it doesn't end any other way. I mean, you can't do that to your deficit and your debt in perpetuity. Once you cross certain thresholds, the two big ones being 10% deficit to GDP and triple digits debt to GDP, you know, Reinhardt and Rogoff have written about this extensively, you know, and historically, that's when your currency is at a very, it's very susceptible to a faster devaluation. So, I you know, that there's a lot, you know, to the answer. I think we can go on and on, like I said, but that's the short answer.
I think it has so much to do with recency bias. And I think, I mean, you talk about, and you help people, you educate people, and you help them learn how to not only invest, but trade more short term. And it's so much of it has to do with psychology.
Yep.
And I think, you know, I'm out on Twitter and I'm listening to kind of the normies, And everyone is just saying that inflation is dead. Inflation is dead. Inflation is dead. You know, even the people, the super, super smart people, like I'd say Dr. Lacey Hunt, you know, he, although he may be on the deflation camp or the disinflation camp, he would never, ever say, I would assume that inflation is dead. But you get a lot of people doing that. So then their response is, well, why can't we print money? Why can't we give everyone $2,000 a month, $5,000 a month in stimulus? Because we have the global reserve currency and we never have to worry about it. So why can't we just print prosperity and consumption? I think that's what it boils down to. But I guess that's a good question. How important is psychology, Keith, for people being successful investors or traders, regardless of the time frame?
Well, I mean, it's one of the top three things. Like, so when I try to show our process or the three heaviest weights in our process, I use a Sierpinski gasket, which is effectively a bunch of triangles within a triangle. It's a fractal pattern. And the three big causal factors within the triangle, we use math, history, and behavioral reality. So behavioral has a lot to do with positioning or latent positioning, like to your point, we also call them macro tourists, which is everybody knows after something happened, right? No shit. I mean, so if you ask anybody on CNBC or anywhere else, they say there's no inflation. Now, well, that's because inflation just hit its quad four deflationary low when the oil price was negative in the middle of this year. If you could just get people to start thinking a little bit differently, and this is where, and I appreciate that, thanks for the compliment. I mean, education and macro awareness are so much better than being a macro tourist. A macro tourist, let's just boil it down. A macro tourist is what a tourist is, jumping from headline to headline, taking pictures, sound bites, right. Wall Street talking points. A full cycle investor, somebody who's macro aware, has this thing called a sine curve and understands that inflation bottoms, accelerates to the peak of the sine curve, and then it starts to slow again, then it bottoms, and it slows again. It's just called a cycle. So you don't have to have this, even, you know, and I think Lacey Hunt over the years, or you pick anybody who's really been permanently bullish on duration or long-term bonds or gold or anything like that, you know, it actually has been a long-term secular bet. The right way to bet is on disinflation or deflation. But now we're at the point where you can't get any lower than a negative oil price. And you can't get any lower than most prices hit in basically March to April of 2020.
Or the zero lower bound on rates, yeah.
Yeah, it was also the global low in interest rates. I mean, the German 10-year was minus 85 basis points. So we're coming off a very asymmetric low from a 30-year move. And that's why you should have the most people, and that's probably why you get the feedback, because you're so generous that you put your content and your views and your thoughts, you know, on a big channel where a lot of people can engage with it. And after 30 years of something doing something, George, of course they don't believe it could do the other thing.
Yeah. That reminds me of something I wanted to get your opinion on. And it's this 60-40 portfolio that every single financial advisor in the whole wide world tells their customers or their clients that you've got to get in. And of what really irritates me about that is that they'll only go back to 1981. Of course, you know, there's cherry, you know, bonds, the price of bonds and equities have all just kind of gone up in almost a straight line when you look at them in nominal terms. And, you know, they just kind of, well, forget about the 70s, 60s, 50s, 40, you know, forget about the 60 years prior to that. But how do you see kind of the 60-40 right now? What would be, I'm assuming moving forward, if we're going to a stagflationary environment, that, you know, the 60-40 is not what people want to be in. And Chris Cole, you know, his great paper confirms that. But how do you see the 60-40, and what advice would you give to just the masses, the 99% of the people out there that are positioned this way?
Well, let's just make it real simple. I mean, 60-40 is a static position. Everything we're trying to invest in, the economy, markets, asset allocations, is nonlinear and dynamic. Why would you have a static solution for something that's linear and nonlinear and dynamic? Why would you do that? That's the first question. Like, you just know you shouldn't be doing that anyway. Now, if I have four economic quadrants and I have four different portfolios for four, you know, think of it like the weather, and a lot of our clients think of it that way too. You know, quad one, two, three, and four are like the four seasons. When winter is coming, why would you hold the same position? I mean, sometimes the position is to have 90% treasuries and 10% dollar and nothing else. That's quad four. You will beat everybody when you hit quad four when winter is coming. You know, so it's not just not 60-40, it's actually using, God forbid, you're being data dependent and flexible. And now what I love about it, George, is that, you know, there was a time not so long ago that it would cost a lot to pivot your, you know, your 401ks or your Roth or whatever, you know, wherever you have your retirement money. But now you don't have to pay commissions on ETFs.
Right.
Like
right.
From a macro top-down perspective, there are 174 ETFs and I pay zero commissions on changing my setup. So again, the setup can be a variety of different setups. What I like to say, again, instead of 60-40, we have, you know, we have four major asset classes, let's just start with, to begin with. You got foreign currency, fixed income, equities, and commodities. That's just to start. And if, when I put Bitcoin in commodities, maximalists lose their minds. I also have wine, you know, art, you know, in the commodity bucket. And I put basically, not to go through the whole thing, but there are peak positions by asset class. You can have a cocktail of, you know, many different permutations of asset allocation depending on what your risk tolerance is and what you're interested in. But just being in equity and fixed income, that's equally stupid. I mean, why would you do that? You're missing out on huge U.S. dollar moves in the foreign currency market and or dollar drawdowns, which make other foreign currencies very interesting investments. And you're missing out on entire asset classes like commodities, which include new and dynamic things like Bitcoin.
Yeah. So what are your views on commodities right now? I've been talking about them for a long time. I think it's they're probably the only things that are maybe quote unquote cheap right now as far as an entire group. And I think what's interesting, I've been telling people this, is prior to COVID, you really didn't have anything, in my opinion, that was like really super, super cheap. But now you've got some things that have been beaten down. So I would assume you're bullish on commodities, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. What do you think?
No, I mean, it's fine. We're actually, this may be the only conversation, at least with a significant enough size audience, where the two people agree on this. I mean, nobody's long commodities. I mean, commodities as an asset class has been shot for dead. I mean, so when you define something as cheap, I mean, if I were to have the slides from my current macro deck, I could show you. I mean, the dollar, much like in the year 2000, 2001, is coming off a multi-year high. You know, it's basically the U.S. dollar trade-weighted index is at the highest level that it's ever been post-World War II. So again, the upside down of that is the price of commodities. Don't forget that 86% of daily trading in commodities settles in dollars. And that's why the correlation between the dollar and commodities is like 85 to 95%, depending on what duration you're looking at. So again, that's why I always say if you get the dollar right, you get commodities right. So if you're bearish on the dollar, you're bullish on commodities. And if you're bullish on the dollar, you're bearish on commodities. So, you know, for me, I'm pretty comfortable with, I love to go both ways and not everybody likes that. But that's life too. I think that when you look at commodities, also from a supply shock perspective, obviously you saw a whole lot of, wow, I didn't realize there wasn't enough food. You know, like you don't have to
bumper to your earlier point.
Yeah, you don't have to be like have some Malthusian view of the world to come up with a supply shortage. But the demand pickup, particularly in emerging markets now, and not even just emerging markets, a place like Japan, which is resource scarce, would be an understatement. You know, they demand food and oil and all the different commodities that are breaking out to the upside now. And so do the Chinese. I mean, so we have a lot of parts of the world that aren't as blessed as the U.S. is in terms of its bounty. And I think that part of the quad one and two story globally, particularly on the emerging market in Asia side, China in particular, and Japan, you know, which is obviously developed world, there's a lot to the commodity bull case, and I continue to work on it every day, trying to keep working on that one.
What are your views on passive and how passive is affecting the overall marketplace? I mean, do we have this scenario where the tail is kind of wagging the dog?
Yeah, passive, I mean, whether ETFs or ETPs, I mean, they've trounced fund flows at any level. I mean, I show this one chart, I could get it to you guys in our deck at slide four, but I mean, it basically shows you the trouncing of passive and ETF-based products that are relative to hedge fund assets, for example, going back, you know, to when I got into the hedge fund business 20 years ago. And I think that's something you should embrace. You can call it passive. I use passive products actively. That's how I do it. I mean, like I said, there are 174 ETFs, and they mimic at least close enough for me. I mean, I trust them to the point that I don't. But I trust them that they're going to mimic the underlying. And again, actively using passive products to me is the way to go. happen.
How much do you think that demand domestically in the U.S. is predicated upon stimulus?
It's a significant part of, if you look at anything that's been surprising, quote unquote, or beating expectations of the upside, it's been more the American consumer. So we're talking about, we're talking about retail sales and services, core goods, things of that nature. But the demand side, particularly on stay-at-home food, was pretty eye-opening. When you look at the breakout in the protein complex, for example, is a pretty easy one to see, or the things that you have to feed the animals to get the protein, which is the big breakout in soy, wheat, corn, et cetera. So that all happened. That's a good example of something happening slowly and then all at once. And this move in corn is a fantastic move to the upside. And there were supply shortages more so on the end product. In grocery stores, as you would know, as if people are just trying to get their head wrapped around this. And the same thing with lumber. Lumber is a great example. People, if you're going to give people, give homes away for no money down or whatever the lowest interest rate you could find, and everyone's leaving the cities and buying up all the homes in Westport, Connecticut, and lumber was in shortage. It was in shortage everywhere. So the price went up, a lot of people were like, oh my God, that's crazy. Well, that's inflation.
Yeah, and they kept people from going to work and creating the lumber because that was right back, when the COVID really came out and was extremely strong with the lockdown. How does that factor into your thinking or your macro assessment as far as the lockdowns? You may be going to a second wave, third wave, or whatever, and especially now with Biden as most likely the president. How do you think about that?
Well, Biden, he's going to get checked by a red Senate now, but the go-to move by the Democrats is to, again, write stimulus checks. So again, I don't think that you're going to have an easing, so to speak, of money, free money handed out from the heavens or wherever we print it from, which is not the heavens. It's actually just, the machine, as you know. So we're going to, that thing's going brrr, and it's just going to keep pumping. So you do a better. I've seen your impersonation of a machine like that. That's what's going to happen. I don't know. It can happen at a lesser rate. If you had a blue wave, I guess you would just, it'd be great. I guess you just take the machine, you print money, you build a bridge with it, you fix the 15,000-16,000 dams in the U.S. that on any given day could collapse. It's great. Create all these jobs, but there's a bill for that, right? And when you're buying the cement or whatever you're buying to fix all these infrastructure problems, the demand for commodities continues to go higher. So, commodities is a big story here that isn't just, hey, we're eating at home. It's base metals. It's infrastructure. It's nationalism. We're long rare earths, for example, because you can't, if you have this view that we're going to have this green America and electrify everything, well, you need copper, you need natural gas, you need rare earths. You can't just have electric vehicles or wind turbines or anything from a power gen perspective without these very basic commodities. So I think that there's a big story underneath that that's going to continue to play out during the Biden administration.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where should they go?
Edgeye.com, or God forbid you go and watch my Twitter handle, you might run into some arguments.
All right, Keith, thanks a lot for your time. I can't wait to do it again, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, George. It was a great conversation.
And guys, I want to let everyone know that if you're interested in checking out Keith's products with Hedgeye, we'll put a link in the description below. He's got a Black Friday special going on right now, so check it out.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.